Well, thank you very much, David, for the introduction, and to the ACI for the invitation to speak to you today. Quite a lot of liquidity up here, I notice, on the stage, but all bottled up with nothing to put it in. I'm not sure what that metaphor means, but anyhow. Welcome back to Sydney. As David was mentioning, the last time that this group in this full form met here was in 1992. Cast our minds back to then. The Australian economy was in the early phase of recovery from a deep recession. But pessimism about the future was deeply rooted here at that time. The financial system was under considerable strain, to say the least. Unemployment was in double digits and still rising. Inflation had fallen significantly, but many people thought that that was a temporary effect of the downturn. They thought that if we did get recovery, and many of them despaired whether we would, but if we did, we would return to our old habits of high inflation. People worried about Australia's substantial current account deficit. There were relatively few, very few, actually optimists about the future. Well, does that sound familiar? You may notice some of that thinking today in the various other countries from which you might have come. I imagine that among the participants of that 1992 meeting, you could have got some pretty long odds against Australia having a long upswing, against us having inflation averaging 2 point something as it has, and against the likelihood of us surviving the financial crisis of the past couple of years and the ensuing global downturn, with in fact one of the mildest downturns that we've had post-World War II, and facing the future with a degree of confidence. So I suppose that shows you that it's hard to forecast, but maybe it also demonstrates that with time and effort and discipline, good policies and, yes, a bit of luck, economies can be returned to health and the citizens that live and work in them to prosperity. To that end, it's helpful that the global financial system is gradually recovering its poise after a near-death experience about 18 months ago. Maybe a bit like a patient that's suffered an acute cardiac event. There has been some lasting tissue damage, but quick intervention avoided something much worse. A period of emergency life support occurred, and that's been followed by a period of recuperation with some ongoing medication, during which the patient has gradually been able to resume normal activities. Certainly the functioning of money markets has improved substantially. Extreme counterparty risk has abated. Spreads of LIBOR to equivalent maturity OIS and things of that nature have come down to about the lowest level since mid-2007. The dramatic expansion in the balance sheets of central banks in the major economies has largely ended, though policy rates remain at 50-year lows. Australia's situation in that regard is a bit more advanced. The expansion in the Reserve Bank of Australia's balance sheet was unwound nearly a year ago now, and the policy rate has been increased somewhat, reflecting the very different circumstances that this economy faces. But we're not the only country seeking to manage the so-called return to normal. A number of countries outside those most directly affected by the crisis are now starting to do that, though the speed of adjustment, of course, depends very much on national circumstances. Capital markets have also improved, with spreads to sovereign yields for private borrowers across much of the risk spectrum back to pre-Lehman levels, and for the best-rated borrowers back almost to mid-2007 levels. Now, they're not quite back to pre-crisis levels, but then again, they probably should never have been at those levels anyway. Similarly, spreads for emerging market sovereigns in most cases are well down from their peaks. In fact, overall borrowing costs for quality corporates and emerging market sovereigns are similar to or slightly below what they were in 2006. This is being accompanied now by a gradual pickup in debt issuance. Appetite for risk has increased significantly since the end of 2008, albeit, of course, occasionally with some setbacks. Of course, we would expect that risk appetite would have increased since September and October of 2008 were characterised by sheer panic, and there is really no other word to use to describe what happened then, and a flight from virtually any risk at all. Once the global system didn't actually go over the precipice, there was always going to be some reappraisal. And so, even as evidence was emerging, at the end of that year and into the early part of 2009, of the dramatic fall in demand for real goods and services around the world, share prices and commodity prices began to recover. Share prices now are about 60% higher than the priced for disaster low point, while commodity indexes have increased by a third, though some individual commodity prices, and particularly ones important to this country, have risen by a lot more. Similarly, we've seen a preparedness to take foreign currency risks, and flows into emerging markets involving both foreign currency and credit risk have increased. Again, risk appetite has not returned to the heady days, but nor should it. And even the flows we have seen to date have begun to raise concerns among policymakers in some of the emerging countries about the potential risks of asset market excesses and eventual capital flow reversal. For major financial institutions, the picture has also improved. The decline in risk aversion has eased funding problems, and a number of countries have been able to terminate or scale back their programs for government guarantee of debt, as banks are increasingly able to issue term funding or access term funding markets under their own names. Share prices for those financial institutions who are still privately owned have generally increased, in many cases by more than the broader market. A number of US and European banks that accepted public capital injections during the crisis have moved to repay them. The challenges that remain ahead for the banking system in major countries nonetheless remain considerable. For a start, the outlook for some of the remaining government ownership stakes is unclear. While losses coming from write-downs of securities slowed down a lot some time back, losses are still occurring in lending books as a result of the normal things that happen in big recessions, not least in the area of commercial property, and that will continue for a while. In addition, banks, particularly large internationally active banks with big trading books, are going to need to have more capital over time under proposed changes to global prudential standards. Now, there's a considerable contrast, actually, between that picture and the one for banks in most other countries. It's important to note that the majority of countries have not had a banking crisis as such. Of course, everybody was affected by the seizure of markets for that period in late 2008. But most have not been afflicted by the sorts of asset quality and capital issues that so bedeviled large US, UK and European banks. And that in turn meant that once the panic subsided, banks in many countries were able to continue to carry out their functions, albeit in much more difficult circumstances, of course, and facing more subdued demand for credit, especially from businesses. Australia is a good example of that, though not the only one. The lowest rate of return on equity earned by the major banks here over this recent period in underlying terms was about 10%. That's plus 10, no minus sign. Among the smallest banks, the return was lower, but still positive. When markets for securitisation closed, the major banks stepped into the gap by increasing their rate of lending for housing, albeit at higher prices. These banks were also able to support some business customers, again at a price, that in previous cycles they might have chosen to cut. Recently, the rate of provisioning for bad loans has stopped rising for a number of banks here, and non-performing loans are likely to peak at a considerably lower share of total loans than had earlier been expected. That general picture, if not the exact numbers, would, I think, probably be replicated across much of the Asian time zone. These differences in experience are an important backdrop for the international work on regulatory reform. There's no question that there has to be considerable reform. To use the medical analogy again, the recovering patient is usually advised to consider some dietary and lifestyle changes and perhaps submit to some ongoing monitoring in order to avoid further emergency procedures. So the changes that are needed involve removing the scope for taking on excessive leverage via regulatory arbitrage, making sure that adequate capital is held against the risks that are being incurred, better management of funding liquidity, countering, to the extent possible, the inherent tendencies in both human nature and in regulation to form assessments of risk in a pro-cyclical fashion, and improving resolution processes so that there can be a more orderly and rapid management of crises, and to manage the issue of too-big-to-fail institutions. Now, they're very important goals, and the Australian authorities support them. But as we've said before, the really serious problems were generated in a relatively small number of very large internationally active banks. They did not stem from the thousands of other banks in the world who have not needed to be bailed out and whose capital has in most cases proved to be adequate to cover normal losses in a cyclical downturn. Hence, it's important not to unnecessarily shackle that latter group in our efforts to constrain the relatively small number who caused the problems. Turning from banks to markets more generally, a recent development, as you'll all be aware, has been the increasing focus on sovereign debt and creditworthiness. The initial manifestation of that was late last year when Dubai World requested a standstill on its debt. More recently, the focus has been on Greece, after it was revealed that the Greek government's current borrowing requirement was much larger than had previously been disclosed. Now, Greece is a very small country. It accounts for about 0.5% of the world's GDP. The significance, of course, is that Greece is a euro area country, and that means two things. Firstly, its adjustment to its predicament can't involve currency depreciation unless it were to choose to leave the single currency. The only way it can grow out of this problem is by gaining competitiveness against other European countries via domestic deflation, and that will be a long and rather difficult process. A very large fiscal consolidation is unavoidably part of that path. Secondly, the rest of the euro area, of course, has an interest in this effort succeeding, and that's why there's such intense discussion about whether and in what form assistance from elsewhere in Europe might be forthcoming. Any assistance, of course, would have to pass the test of credibility more generally across Europe and would need to be applicable under similar terms to other euro area countries if that were needed. Obviously, that's a very difficult problem and one which, as we sit here, the policymakers concerned are still working on. But perhaps the broader significance is that the difficulties facing Greece, while unusually stark, are in fact a reminder of the challenges facing a number of other countries in Europe, and for that matter the United States and the United Kingdom, over the long haul. Ratios of debt to GDP in all these countries are rising quite substantially at present. Now, there are several reasons for that. One is the size of the recessions. The so-called automatic stabilisers, where revenues fall and expenditure on unemployment benefits and so on increase in a recession, they're at work. Those forces are bigger, actually, in many European countries than elsewhere, but they happen everywhere to some extent. The second factor has been the discretionary budgetary decisions to have fiscal stimulus and, of course, to inject capital into banks where that was needed. In the circumstances, the former was understandable and the latter, the capital injections, of course, were unavoidable. Well, the automatic stabilisers will presumably automatically move budget positions back in the right direction as economies recover. The costs of stimulus and bank rescue measures, while one-off in nature, do leave debt permanently higher, but without such measures, economies might well have suffered much deeper downturns, and so the extent of budget deterioration would have been even greater, itself leaving a bigger legacy. Well, if that was the end of the story, then I think maybe we wouldn't want to get too hung up about debt ratios. Unfortunately, though, there is more to the story than that. For several important countries, there was a trend increase in debt-to-GDP ratios going on before any of this happened. Now, for the domestic audience, I need to be clear here, and this is in bold text in the written version. I'm not talking about Australia here. We were a conspicuous exception to this trend. But particularly in mainland Europe, the pattern has tended to be for debt ratios to rise quickly when there's a recession, to be stable then for a few years after that, and then go up again the next time there's a recession. A lot of factors at work here, but the interaction of changing demographics and generous welfare systems, health and retirement systems, obviously are prominent. Those same factors also work, of course, other things equal, to lessen future potential economic growth in those countries. It's certainly not unprecedented for countries to have debt stocks much larger than their GDP, as some countries are going to, if they don't already. That's usually been seen when countries have faced the requirement to fight a war or something like that. The ratios subsequently came down when the emergency passed. But the situation now is different to that. The decline in debt ratios we saw after World War II, for example, was driven very strongly by rapid growth in output as population expanded and as productivity surged. That won't easily be repeated in many of the major countries this time around. It's these more deep-seated trends in debt, public debt, which were in place before the crisis, that really are the greater cause for concern. The crisis has simply brought them more clearly into focus. The demographic drivers will continue for the foreseeable future, while the unwillingness or inability to tackle the structural trends in earlier good times has significantly reduced future flexibility for a number of these countries. So a number of advanced industrial countries face some difficult fiscal decisions in the years ahead. At some point, significant discretionary tightening is going to be required. Of course, it's true that policymakers need to get recoveries well entrenched first, which is why many observers warn against attempting an early fiscal consolidation. But unless a credible path to fiscal sustainability can also be set out, growth could easily be stunted by rising risk premia built into long-term interest rates at some point, as markets worry about long-run solvency. That's not happening now. At the moment, long-term interest rates in all these countries remain quite low. That provides a window within which to plan the eventual consolidation. Since markets can be fickle and things can change, governments surely will be wanting to use that window in that way. In the meantime, differences persist in the pace of economic recovery around the world. In the US, growth spurred by, initially at least, a turn in the inventory cycle is thought to have marked the turning point in the second half of last year. But most observers still expect only pretty moderate growth in the US this year. In Europe, the momentum of recovery, I think, has been considerably less clear. Certainly in both these cases, the old forecasting cliche about more than the usual amount of uncertainty applies in spades on this occasion. In contrast to that, it is apparent that the letter V is a reasonable description of the trajectory to date of the important emerging economies like China, India, Brazil, and a number of those other countries in smaller East Asian countries. we'd expect actually to see some moderation in the pace of growth in these cases this year. That's usually the case in a V-shaped recovery because the initial pace of upswing is clearly greater than the long-run sustainable growth rate. That's what will happen to output. The question of what happens to demand in these countries is, of course, a distinct one from what happens to production. Full employment in parts of the emerging world will probably be reached before full employment is reached in North America or Europe. Productive capacity, therefore, will remain to meet further demand from the emerging world via imports of goods and services from the old world. That is to say, emerging Asia and some other parts of the world could see their living standards rise faster than the increase in their own productivity, at least for a while, if they were prepared to meet some demand via imports. Facilitating that most efficiently would, of course, involve, among other things, allowing exchange rates to move. The alternative approach would be to seek to slow growth in demand in the emerging countries as their own production approaches full capacity, so as to maintain internal balance at a given set of exchange rates. But that would leave unused capacity in the major industrial countries, and it would leave emerging world living standards lower than they could be. Now, they're two polar cases that I've set out. Of course, people could choose to do something in between. Among Asian policymakers, many factors go into thinking about exchange rates and trade and capital flows. They have a degree of suspicion about rapid capital flows and large movements in exchange rates, and that's understandable given the events of the late 1990s. It's also understandable that very small economies, a number of whom have trade shares in excess of 100% of their GDP, don't want to see volatile exchange rates because it's very disruptive. Moreover, this issue, and I think this is often forgotten, this issue goes well beyond exchange rates per se. It goes to saving and investment patterns, to the whole national approach, to how you get growth and how quickly those approaches can be changed. The point, nonetheless, though, is that current and prospective differences in economic circumstances between significant parts of the world are likely to put strains on relative settings of macroeconomic policies and on exchange rate arrangements. And that's going to need careful management by all sides over the next few years. Well, let me conclude. The stabilisation of financial markets and banking systems over the past year or more is a welcome development for all of us. There are still difficulties to overcome for financial institutions in some key countries as a result of the depth of the recessions, and these will be the subject of attention over the coming year. Looking ahead, the differences in speed of economic recovery are starting to present challenges of their own, showing up as they do in capital flows, asset valuations, and exchange rates. When we add to all that the looming long-term requirement for fiscal consolidation in a number of major countries, there's plenty for markets and policymakers alike to think about. I'm sure your conference will take up these and other issues with great energy, and I certainly wish you every success in doing so. Thank you very much.
Can I start with one, Governor, concerning your remark on more capital for trading books. Now, this is something which intrigues us and potentially terrifies us. Do you see this process working through national supervision, through the revising of the Basel Accord? And if I can ask you to add on to that, what do you make of the potential threat to us from the so-called Volcker Rule?
Well, the way this will occur is through the internationally agreed set of Basel II rules as they become amended, and I think it's already been agreed that there's going to be changes to capital rules on trading book assets. More generally, there's, as you know, a very big agenda that's being worked on by Basel, but also by other international groups. It's a huge agenda being done under quite a bit of pressure of time. And I think the task before the regulatory community is to address the very real concerns that governments and our collective citizens reasonably have about what went wrong, but do that in a way which does actually target the problems and doesn't, unduly impair the capacity of common or garden everyday banks to do their job. It's going to be a very challenging task, I think, to get the right balance there, but that is the job before us. I don't have any sense on the Volcker Rule as to how that's going to play either in the US or more generally. I think it's inevitable that proposals of that nature are going to be put forth in varying countries. What we need to do is to come up with some generally agreed ground rules that we can all work within in all the various countries and go from there. And that is a very big challenge.
Would it concern you if trading risk escaped from banks because of maybe an ill-judged target?
Well, let me generalise a bit. It's a good question, but the general question is whether much tougher regulation on a particular part of the financial system actually drives the activity outside the regulatory net. Now, people in this country who've got a memory of the days, when I joined the Reserve Bank, that problem was very real here. We had a whole post-war architecture of strong regulation on banks, and guess what? By the mid-70s, the non-banks were actually bigger, and they were where many of the problems ended up showing up. So I think that is a very real question, and that set of considerations certainly has to be borne in mind as we construct the regulatory system. But I don't think there's any doubt, is there, that in the part of the system that the public purse has had to rescue in so many major countries, it's going to happen that there's got to be more capital put up against the risks those people were running. There is no way that not just the regulators, but the political process can allow things to go on as they were. That's not going to happen. So we have to find a way of having proper capital against the risk, but be cognizant of not wanting to end up with all the risk being run somewhere that we can't see.
Colin, there's a question.
David Bloom from HSBC. It's a question really about interest rates and the transparency of interest rates. That before the financial crisis, if you take the Greenspan era, Mervyn King as well, yourselves, you gave us pretty much certainty when you were going to move rates, and the market was quite sure you moved rates, it wasn't a big deal. It seems that after this financial crisis, the Fed raises the discount rate, nobody was sure about their timing. Yourselves, two decisions ago, people thought you'd raise rates, you left them unchanged. The South Africans last night, cut interest rates unexpectedly. Is this a change in policy, or do central banks actually not know before the decision what it's going to turn out to be? Because there's been a distinct change. You may not see it in yourself, but throughout financial markets throughout the world, the way central banks are behaving, the way they are transmitting messages about interest rates has become a lot less transparent than it was before. And Mervyn King was very proud that all central bank decisions should be completely expected, shouldn't be a big deal in the markets, yet now they are and they've become a game. Has something changed inside yourself as a central bank, or do you think something's changed globally about the way you transmit messages about your interest rate decisions?
Well, I think one of the problems in the pre-crisis risk build-up period was arguably, pardon me, a little bit too much comfort being taken by financial markets and borrowers generally that central bank would never hurt them or surprise them. But I don't think any central bank, we have certainly never made a commitment that there'll not be surprises, and nor should we, and nor should any central bank, in my opinion. What we can say, excuse me, is that you ought to be able to think about our decisions within an agreed framework as to what the objectives of policy are and how we go about pursuing those objectives. And I think that framework remains in place, certainly in our case. It's possibly more difficult elsewhere where unconventional things have had to be done and everybody's working in unfamiliar territory. But here, we've got the same framework, the same objective, the same modus operandi, but there'll still be the occasional controversy over did they or didn't they or will they or won't they in this particular month. I don't actually think from an overall perspective that's all that big a deal, frankly.
Thank you. I think that's Ray Attrell. Is it down there?
Ray Attrell from Forecast. Governor Stevens, I know the main topic today has really been on the global economy and international finance, but I wondered if I could ask you something slightly more parochial. And when we came in this morning, the front page of the Financial Review is telling us that the RBA has said that mortgage rates need to rise by another 0.5%. I think it was in reference
to... Oh, I read that too.
In reference to some comments that were allegedly made by the assistant governor yesterday. But one specific topic that I think occupies a lot of commentators here in Australia is the strength of the housing market, and the RBA has talked at length about the fundamental drivers of supply and demand in the housing market, and particular concerns that a bubble not be allowed to develop and how that impacts on policy. One of the things we've not seen any reference from the RBA to of late is the impact of the abolition of restrictions on temporary residents and foreign investors being allowed to purchase property in Australia, and some press commentators have started to flag that as a potentially significant driver of house price strength here. And I just wondered if you had anything to say on that, and I guess if the answer is yes, whether the implication is that monetary policy is not going to be a particularly effective tool to lean against strength that comes from that source.
The question of the role of foreign purchases is an important one, and it's one that we're giving some attention to. It's also one where everybody's got an anecdote, but where hard facts are harder to come by. In part, that's because the restrictions were eased, and so the factual basis on which one could form an opinion about the prominence of foreign buyers is more limited. And it certainly, as you say, if it were a large-scale phenomenon and those people are not borrowing the money here, then it's certainly true that nothing we did would make any difference to them. But, of course, the housing market's a lot broader than just that. It is most likely, I think, as far as we can tell, that while there probably is some more prominence of foreign buyers, it's most likely still a very small share of overall turnover, and that mostly what's pushing up housing prices over the past 15 months or more is Australians who are, for their own reasons, seeking to get or to upgrade their accommodation. And It, without a stronger factual basis to make any comments about foreign purchases, and I think it's undoubtedly a factor, but I don't think we can assume that it's a really big factor short of having some stronger information to that effect. So I think probably for the most part it's us that's doing it. And there are a whole bunch of factors at work that you've referred to, and so I won't go through all those again, but you know, it is a phenomenon that we're obviously taking a close interest in.
Paul Verscher from Westpac. Governor Stevens, in the US at the moment, there are regulations being drafted that appear to be more addressing domestic concerns than global concerns. However, these regulations will have a major effect on the global environment. How is your voice or an Australian voice get heard in that debate?
Well, all politics is always local, isn't it? And I don't think the US is the only country where there are proposals emanating from political leaders for various changes that are motivated by the events that have occurred and the political fallout that they've experienced as a result. So I don't think that's new at all. That's the way the world has always been. What's Australia's capacity to put our voice? Well, I guess one advantage that we have that we have not always had is actual membership of the Basel Committee, the Financial Stability Board and so on, where one can put our point of view. And I've said all the things in those forums that I've said earlier today in my talk. And I think there's an opportunity there for reasonable people to make these points. And I don't think we are the only country that would make some of these points. Realistically, though, we've got to keep in mind that, you know, we're a fairly small country, 1.5% of the world's GDP. We'll be given our due hearing and hopefully be able to help fashion these things and have some influence at the margin, but we obviously are not in a position to kind of throw our weight around all that much, because there's not of that much of that weight. That's just the way it is. So we have to work on having good arguments, making good sense and trying to persuade people of the points of view that we have, and that's what we're seeking to do.
Bill Evans from Westpac. Governor Stevens, I was recently in the US, and I was very surprised at the degree of scepticism that big US investors have about the China story. We at Westpac are very positive about China achieving a soft landing, and I understand the bankers as well. But obviously it's something that we need to monitor pretty closely. In terms of your monitoring of the Chinese ability to engineer this soft landing and not to avoid anything nastier, what sort of variables do you watch in terms of the trying to understand what's actually happening in China? What do you find the most important variables to give you that indication?
I'm going to give you the same answer I always give, Bill, to the question, what's the key variable you're looking at? And the answer is all of the ones we can find. I think I myself have heard this same scepticism about China from US investors. I was hearing it 3, 4, and 5 years ago. I think that those people have underestimated both the fundamental things which are driving China and the determination of the Chinese authorities themselves to grow their economy at a pretty strong pace. Now, there's no guarantee at all that everything will turn out just right in China. But I think we might give them some credit for a decade plus for having managed things in a reasonably effective way up there. So I think there's certainly a need for caution, particularly for Australia, in thinking about China, where it is not going to be a situation of just sitting back and letting the riches roll in. China is more complex than that. China has a business cycle like any other economy. It's going to have ups and downs. It will, I think, be a high mean growth rate, but quite possibly a high variance one as well, and we will feel that. So we've got to think about how to manage that. I think the best thing I can say on the monitoring is it's impossible really to put too many resources into doing this, and I think we've got to just grab every piece of information we can and try to make sense of the jigsaw, which is really what we're doing for our own economy as well. So no particular variable, just an ongoing intense effort to understand how all the pieces fit together up there.
Good morning, Governor Stevens. Eric Latus from Wolverine Trading in Chicago. Following up on your comments about China and also on Prime Minister Keating's, I'm curious what you think about the apparent stalemate that exists right now between the United States in particular, but really the entire Western world and China with regard to the value of the renminbi. It seems to me, anyway, that there is something of a standoff here in which the United States and other countries want to see an appreciation in the Chinese currency. The Chinese do not want to appreciate it for competitive reasons, but also they, I think, have another issue, which is the massive amount of U.S. Government debt that they've been purchasing over time. Any devaluation of their currency would, or sorry, appreciation of their currency would devalue their holdings. And so it seems to me that there's something of a mutually assured, well, if not destruction, at least degradation in economic outlooks, with the U.S. holding the threat of protectionism and trade restrictions over the Chinese, and the Chinese refusing to relent on the strength of the currency. That's at least my perception. I'm really curious about your thoughts on that, and if this is a view that you see being prevalent, or how you see this playing out and hopefully getting resolved.
Well, I think I would start with the observation that we know that the real value of the RMB is going to be higher through history, much higher, actually, than it is today. Everybody knows that. There's, of course, more than one way you can do that. You can have domestic price and cost inflation, which will do the same thing effectively. Or you can revalue the nominal exchange rate or some combination. So I don't think there's any doubt which way in the long run it goes, and it's a matter of finding a manageable path to that long run. And I think everybody knows that, the Chinese authorities know that. My second observation is this is another area where all politics is local, and a lot of talking that gets done on both sides here is actually aimed not at the other side but at domestic constituencies. It is possible that more progress will be made if the loud hailers were put away, and some of these discussions were done a little bit more in private. But possibly that's too hard to do, I don't know. But you know, everyone knows which way this goes in the long run, and I think the Chinese authorities understand that, but they've got a whole lot of considerations at work, not just responding to pressure from the US side. In the fundamental analysis, ultimately, I think the Chinese authorities will adjust the currency in a way which is in their own interests. It is actually in their interest for it to be higher over time. But that's the main reason they will eventually do it.
Good morning, Governor Stevens. I'm Mr. Lito from Bank of the Philippines. I just want to ask about your comments. In line with the recent hikes in interest rates of the RBA, and same thing for ASEAN economies like China, Malaysia, and even China tightening their policy rates. My question is, are you seeing any risk on the with regards to short-term flows and maybe volatility in interest rates if in case there are changes in the market fundamentals related taking advantage of these higher yields for the economies that were leading the hikes. And if ever there is some risk in your assessment, are there some deliberate policy assessments to more or less temper the volatility on the currency rates related to this? Thank you.
Well, you know, the countries that are recovering most quickly, which generally are in this time zone, though not all of them, but there's quite a few of them in this time zone, you would expect, firstly, that their policies will tighten earlier, and secondly, that international capital will want to flow there, not only because of the policy measures, but because the strength of the economic growth, return to capital and so on is favourable. And let's face it, you know, the Asian region is one of the places in the world where the rate of return on capital is likely to be most attractive for quite a long time. It makes sense for capital to flow to that region. It has never made all that much sense, really, for there to be a persistent long-run flow of capital out of Asia to America or Europe. There were particular reasons that happened after the crisis, building up reserves as insurance and so on, but you would think, as a long-run phenomenon, that capital really should flow from the old world to the emerging world where the returns will be higher. It is then a matter of managing the risks that can come with that, and those, I think that for the most part, managing those risks comes down to the quality of your domestic policies across the board. Supply-side policies in your real economy, financial policies, supervision, quality of monetary policy and so on, all those things are important in managing these foreign flows of capital so that you don't waste them and you use them well. And that, by the way, goes just as much for this country as for any of the emerging market countries in our region. And we are seeing, and I think we'll continue to see, quite substantial flows of capital to Asia and to Australia for quite some years.